So before I start, I just want to thank you all for staying awake until the last session. I won't blame you if you don't stay awake throughout the whole talk, maybe a little bit.
Whatever you have.
Okay, yes. All right, I'll take that as a challenge, Lee. So here in my talk, I will talk about shape dynamics, but I will actually talk about some other motivations that you can also find for shape dynamics, even if you're not a strict relationalist in the sense that we have been talking about here. In a sense, you could say like a meta shape dynamics and other principles. So let me start by just looking at these three guys. So this one here, you guys know, is Heisenberg. This guy here, you guys know as well, is Bohr. This, I don't know if everybody knows. He's Sir Neville Mott. And they were very involved in a debate that came around right after the advent of quantum mechanics. People didn't really know what was happening in this wave-particle duality. People didn't understand. And there were all this, and Einstein actually asked them about this question about this bubble chamber where you have some alpha particle and it decays, and this alpha particle decays and goes and nucleates all these bubbles. And Einstein asked, so the wave function is actually spherically symmetric. Why does it form these collinear rays in these bubbles? What is going on there? And then, you know, as usual, Bohr and Heisenberg started answering him or resolving the question. And eventually, Mott actually put everything in nice mathematical form in this paper, The Wave Mechanics of Alpha Ray Tracks. And so as he says, this suggested by a recent paper by Darwin, and I think it's not the same Darwin, otherwise he was really prolific.
It's grandson.
Oh, really?
Evolved.
Oh, man. He evolved.
It was another Charles.
No, not that one. Perhaps it is Charles. I don't know. Anyway, it's the grandson. And the father distinguished the son's grandson.
Anyways, it's not going to be a biographical talk. So I think we can move on. So Darwin said, take a problem which would be regarded at first sight as irreconcilable with a pure wave theory, but thoroughly typical of the behavior of particles, and show how, in fact, the correct result arises naturally from consideration of waves alone. And he actually finds all, basically the correct, just heuristically, he finds the correct explanation for it. And he concludes, which I will show, and he says, so without pretending to have mastered the details, we can understand how it is possible that the psi function, so to speak, not to know in what direction the track is to be, but yet to insist that it should be a straight line. The decision as to actual track can be postponed until the wave reaches the uncovered part where the observations are made. Right. And then Mott, in the end, one of the comments that is also important to us is he says, the problem is the tendency to picture the wave as existing in ordinary three-dimensional space, whereas we are really dealing with wave functions in multispace formed by the coordinates both of the alpha particle and of every atom in the Wilson chamber. So the bubble chamber is called the Wilson chamber. And the point is that we'll find that under suitable assumptions, the two hydrogen atoms cannot both be excited or ionized unless they are along a straight line. Right, so here's a picture of this bubble chamber. It's just a photograph. You can see the straight lines. And this is the question that they were asking. So I'm just gonna very briefly go through a simplified treatment of this, because in the end we'll find a formula for what I intend to do in shape space, which is similar to the formula that they find. This is actually a treatment by Halliwell, but it's very similar to Mott's. It's just simplified. So here you have some H-naught, so it's just some Hamiltonian of the whole system, or the non-interaction Hamiltonian. Here is the interaction Hamiltonian with some interaction parameter and some constant energy. And you model all the detectors, I don't care how many, although people originally did it with just for two detectors, two state detectors. And you just model them, it's very simple, just with two states, and you have some lowering and raising operators, and you have some function here which is localized. Okay, it's something that will localize these atoms or whatever. And the point is that you can actually solve perturbatively for this wave function. You separate it like this, and then you put in some initial conditions. You say, look, I'm going to separate the wave function into a wave function for the alpha particle and for the detectors, but I'll assume that if I had at lambda zero, so with no interaction, interaction turned off, none of the two-state detectors are excited. And right, and then you just do a summation here. All of these j's can be either 0 or 1 for the ith perturbation, and here you would have a certain number of excited detectors. So I'm not going to derive the how you get to this, but it's really quite simple when you just write the perturbation parameter. And all you need to use the green functions of the unperturbed Hamiltonian. Okay? So with particular boundary conditions, and this will be very important. And what you find is that for n of these detectors to be excited, and for QF to be one of them, what you find is that you take the original wave function and you just propagate it. From F to F, from bubble to bubble, with the Green's functions of the unperturbed Hamiltonian. Right. So I already lost my challenge. And
sorry, F is a localizing function, right?
Yes, right. F is a localizing function. Right.
And psi n is a state with n.
Right, with n bubbles appearing.
N
what?
No. That's the probability amplitude of exciting n randomly distributed atoms, right?
Right.
Not on a line.
Right.
Okay.
Precisely. So sorry. QF. Yes. I should have said that.
So QF is a localized.
Right. Yes. It's what if QF is one of these n bubbles?
So that's the transition amplitude for the alpha particle to be at the QF
right.
Location.
Right, and I have some symmetrizations here as well. You need some symmetrizations, but they won't be important for what I'm talking about.
It's the alpha particle that's in the WKB, which is coming out aesthetically symmetric with nice spherical.
Right.
And the mystery is why then you get the straight line.
Yes, right. And so you can really see, if you do a WKB semi-classical approximation here, so this is, you think of this as slowly varying with respect to this, and if you put it, and you define this on-shell momenta basically as the gradients in the final point and in the beginning of this, so this here, usually when you solve the Schrodinger equation for this becomes a Hamilton-Jacobi functional. But so in this approximation here, when you actually substitute this back there, you find this expression here. Okay? And from here you can already see what was the main observation of these guys. Is that for stationarity actually means that the gradient of S at an initial point, is this correct? Yes. So that the gradient of this on-shell function between these two things has to actually match, or one has to be the negative of the other.
How do I interpret that?
Right. So these are basically the momenta, so the incoming momenta and the outgoing momenta. from the same point. So they have to be collinear. They have to be at the same in the same direction.
So this is identical to the derivation of the path integral from the discretization of paths.
Right. It's
physical. It's
yeah. And so they find, well, so whatever it is that happens, Qi would have to lie in the classical path, or it would be peaked when Qi lies in the classical path from Qi minus 1, so from this configuration to this configuration. And the integral will be larger when these localizations are actually have support along the same classical path, right? So this is the observation then that all of these things will form. You don't know which classical path they will form on, but they should form along the same extremal trajectories. And the point that I made here is, importantly, one does need boundary conditions for this. So you are assuming somehow that the initial wave function was localized. And you're also assuming that there was no detector excited before the experiment began. This is in their interpretation. This is how they justify some boundary conditions for the Green's functions that you find here, because you could also have the homogeneous solutions, and they set those to zero. Yes, Julian?
All of the atoms in the cloud chamber in the ground state, which is a low entropy state, what you said something else, something more on the boundary condition, which I didn't catch.
Boundary conditions for the Green's function.
Initially local.
What did you say was localized?
They're all
in the ground state, the atoms.
Right, the atoms.
And the alpha particle is coming out in the WKB aesthetically symmetric.
Right, but
so that's the key initial condition.
Exactly. Yes, yeah. That's the key initial condition. It's that you, because you could assume, usually even in WKB, you could assume a summation over WKB parts, right? You could assume something like this, where. But they say, well, no, it is actually localized, and you only have one of these. There's no summation. I'm simplifying a little bit. There's more to this, but this is included in the Green's functions, and in fact, it's included in this psi q1. So it's of the alpha particle that is coming out. They assume it's coming out from some origin. So that's crucial in their derivation. So, okay. So my point here, and the question that I wanted to ask is, can Mott be a starting point to solve some main of the conceptual problems of quantum gravity? And first, I want to make a disclaimer. I'm not the first one to suggest this. Julian has papers on has commentary and papers, and has been cited by Halliwell as being some of the first people that actually.
The person who really gives them fantastic treatment is this John Bell's Quantum Mechanics for Cosmologists, where he explains the Mott paper. And then he dismisses it as solipsism, denial of the past. But it's a fabulous paper.
Right. Yeah. And, well, we have been accused of being solipsists as well, right, Julian? So maybe this is fitting.
Every other week.
Every other week, yeah. So why do I think we have to look at this again is because I want to bring new considerations into this problem in terms of quantum gravity. Basically, shape space, looking at things in shape space, and paying attention to the topology of shape space. And so I said, you know, I talked about some of the main conceptual problems of quantum gravity. So what are they, or what do I think they are? In my opinion, there is a fundamental clash. So on one side, you have quantum mechanical properties, which I single out the two that I think really clash with general relativistic properties. It's the quantum superposition principle and a non-locality of instantaneous measurements. And I think they do clash with general relativistic notions of a fixed causal structure, right? Because if you have a quantum superposition principle and you have masses localized in different places, which one is sourcing the energy moment, the gravitational part, the geometry, and it's not very clear how this works, right? Because we also think of things being superposed at an instant of time, but if the metric is not fixed, what does that even mean in GR? And the non-locality of instantaneous measurements also clashes with space-time covariant. In quantum mechanics, you know, measurements are made at an instant, and in GR, the observables are supposed to be the whole space-time, right? So how do you jive these two things? I mean, the observables in GR need to depend on the whole space-time because it needs to be four-diff covariant. And this still leaves out the measurement problem in the foundations of quantum mechanics, which I think this Mott thing does address in a different context, which I will express here.
So you say that GR observables are integrals of global, but if you have also matter, then you can also have local.
Right. That's true. That's true. I'm thinking about vacuum here in this talk,
that doesn't change the discussion, right? It's localized things with matter, but you need to put the matter field in a particular state in order to localize. So it's
right. Okay, so. And I still haven't really talked about, I don't think I will have to talk about the relation of philosophy of shape dynamics. If you're not converted by now, there's nothing I can do. So very much like in Tim's talk, one of my motivations is that I also think we should want a separation between the law and the objects that the law act on. I have phrased this before as a distinction between something that some causal behavior and acausal behavior. What can you set separately, and what may depend on what may have interrelations and how they evolve?
I didn't get this.
No, it's just it's exactly so. In the same sense that Tim talked about the objects the law act on, so you think about an evolution. When we think about GR, what we're interested in, we want to have some hyperbolic equations to talk about predictions about how things evolve. And GR, the covariant formalism, these things are not that clear anymore. You have causal structure, right? But it's already at the kinematical level. You don't even need to solve Einstein's equations to have a causal structure if you have a Lorentzian metric, for example. And
well, if you want to make trouble here, I can make a little trouble. If you're a real relationalist, part of relationalism is Einstein's principle of reciprocity, that everything that's acted on gets acted on back again. Everything that acts gets acted on back again. So if you have things that, mm-hmm. that act on other things, if A acts on B, then B is better act on A.
Right.
And so it's not clear that you should have a distinction between things that act and things that are acted on.
Right, so you're talking about the problem with gravity. With covariant GR.
But I think there's a general principle.
Right, but here I'm actually separating. No.
What about,
I'm just making trouble.
But what about that? I know we recognize that argument. We use it against Bohmian mechanics, right? But what about treating, like, what about the Hamilton-Jacobi functional in classical anything, right? Does that thing get acted on by, it certainly guides everything that happens.
I'm just making trouble. If you believe that there are laws which act on matter and matter does not act on laws to change the laws, you're not being a pure relationalist.
I think that's going way beyond what relationalism is.
Okay.
Relational extremism.
Not going to raise it again.
But Tim, what?
Because you referred to my.
Yes.
I would at least say that this is quite different from what I said. I said when we state physical laws, we state them in terms of physical quantities. But then a physical object, the thing that we want to describe as the law, is in part or is defined by its physical properties. So the disentanglement of G the physical properties that we need to specify for which object the law applies, and then the independent statement of the law, that is independent once I've identified the object, that is the relational prediction. So it's a disent.
Right, it's this. No, but it's
law from.
Right, it is the same way that I see it here. That's what I'm saying. Maybe I haven't expressed myself correctly, but this is how I see it. It's how you define things that make sense here, and then you need to describe how they are going to evolve or relate to each other. And so, and like in Tim's talk, I also think, you know, that you need relation. You only have relational access to such objects, and this brings us to shape space, or rather, and this is what I meant, that this is a kind of like a meta shape dynamics theory, because I'm thinking in a more general terms. I will also assume that you have a reduced configuration space under local symmetries in the more general framework. And in my view, I mean, I have talked about this quite a bit with Wolfgang, and I don't really know how to make sense of these things in when I want to apply them to fundamentally refoliation invariant theories. Unlike Tim, well, maybe I should have put this here as well, but in the semi-classical approximation, I want the dynamics in each path in shape space to be expressible locally, okay, in some gauge. So in this sense, I'm not gonna be Bohmian. And I will also have no evolution parameter inbuilt, only emergent order. Yes, Sean?
But in the semi-classical approximation, the Bohmian trajectory are local.
No, you will see what I mean. But
the dynamics.
Yeah. Right. So, I can show you what I mean.
Perhaps you just want classical behavior to emerge without being put in through the straitjacket of the Bohmian interpretation.
Right, I think that might be a more accurate.
Yeah. Which is not to be taken as a criticism of what Tim is doing, because I think there's some promise in that.
No, sure. It's just a different
just
point of view.
What your difference between
right. Them. I think it's fine. I mean, I really like what Tim is doing. I think it's very worthwhile, and he seems to be getting somewhere with it. I'm just taking a different view on that. Right. So let me be very bold. Lee always asks me to be bold when I talk, and so this goes against my fiber, but so I will construct a theory which has no non-unitary measurement process. It will uniquely construct the Born rule as a volume element in the reduced configuration space. And I think that time, including space-time, will emerge as an effective concept and is going to be valid only for certain curves in configuration space and not assumed from the start. The space-time part here I'm not going to address in this talk. There is other work that shows once you have a curve of shapes, you can reconstruct the space-time from that if you have relational quantities. This is not something that I will have time to address here. And I also want to show conservation of positive probability currents in the appropriate limits and a Schrodinger equation which will dictate the evolution of a weakly coupled source field on a classical gravitational background. And then, hopefully, I'll have time to illustrate these constructions with a simple quantum gravitational toy model, for which the formalism is mostly applicable, with some cheats. So, all right. So the prerequisites are quite simple. I'm not going to be assuming, you know, very crazy things. Just the usual. So I will have M be a closed topological manifold. So I just want some notion of a weak notion of locality of neighborhoods. Let's say, for instance, is the three sphere. Configuration space Q. So if you want an example, take the space of three-dimensional Riemannian matrix. And here I will require a local gauge group. So by local, I mean that it has to act locally in M and pointwise on configuration space, right? And this is already very restrictive for metric variables. if you look at this for metric variables, there aren't that many that you can find. Roberto, you look puzzled. I'm gonna call you out. Okay. M is finite dimensional. It's S3. It's just a three sphere.
What do you mean by act locally?
Are you excluding diffeomorphisms? I think that's the question.
No, I'm not excluding diffeomorphisms. So act locally, it needs to depend on a finite number of derivatives of the right.
Okay.
But it has to be pointwise on configuration space. So it's actually ultra locally in configuration space itself. It only depends if it acts on a metric. It only depends on the metric and that metric. Can depend on that metric everywhere, but only on that metric. And that is already super restrictive. In fact, I mean, if you just put these things in, it's a you basically just get conformal transformations and diffeos. But right. But this is the real thing that I'm gonna need, and it's something. I'll demand that there exists a unique orbit of this quotient space corresponding to the most homogeneous element. Yeah, it's going to be the one with the highest dimensional isotropy subgroup of this full group. Okay, so you can think of this as the simplest element in a way.
You mean most symmetric,
right? The most symmetric, right. And I will also have a pre-probability function such that, so this is basically, I will tell you how to construct an amplitude, but then I'll need to go from this amplitude to some kind of volume form on shape space. And for that, I need some function that goes from the complex numbers to the positive real numbers. And for some of the constructions that I want to construct, I will need this property here. That it decomposes. And in fact, this is equivalent to F being homogeneous. We'll see a simple. Right, so an example would be just Z squared. Right. So element one, let me just remind you, the local gauge group allows me to form a fibration of a configuration space. So this is my configuration space. I can fiber it through these orbits. They act pointwise, I can project them. So as we were talking with Jim Eisenberg, remember that refoliations don't act like this, right? You can't go to a reduced configuration space of GR, right? So this is already not allowed there. And it also allows me to have a gauge connection one form. I can actually split each one of these fibers into a horizontal direction and along a curve, I can split this curve along a horizontal direction and a vertical direction. So I can say, well, along this curve, I'm going to define some notion of what is pure gauge and a notion of what is pure change. This is very much along lines of Julian's best matching. I mean, this is it's the mathematical rephrasing of what Julian wanted to do with the best matching. Here's just a more general, because I can have more general connection forms. So I can have any curve here in base space, and then I can lift it. I choose an initial point, and I lift it to configuration space. So that way gives me a way to represent this just in terms of normal metric variables. Right. So now I'll given an action function respecting the given gauge symmetry, I will define a propagator. So for example, for ream, maybe this is going to be too much, too technical, but I start from an initial point and I parallel translate every path. So I can lift each path uniquely, each path from reduced configuration space, I can lift it uniquely if I choose an initial point, right? So then you have something like this. You have something like here, this is the reduced configuration space. I have all these paths. And here, let's say, sorry, I have this bigger space. And I choose an initial point here. And then I can parallel translate all of them to a final orbit. But of course, they might not, for the conformal lift, they all end up at the same point in this orbit. But for diffeomorphisms, because the curvature of this field space connection is not zero, they might end up in all sorts of points. But you can integrate over the group and you won't have any redundancy here.
How do you guarantee that the measures invariant under that look?
That for example, I'm actually using the measure of Riemann, which is I'm imposing that it's right. So in the connection form here, if I use the connection form, you're gonna get a Jacobian, because it needs to have some projection onto the horizontal components. And this can be or not field dependent in different ways. I'm not going to. Right. Right. It's slightly different because I'm not thinking of it as a gauge fixing, as a whole section. So it's kind of like a Fadiv Popov for velocities in this case. You can.
The lifting of the initial point is it arbitrary or
right? You choose it. Right. No. That's right. So that's what I wrote here. So because as you see, I will fix my initial point and I will define it a wave function only in the second variable. So you choose it. It has to be invariant on the.
So it won't play a role if I choose another one.
Right. Right. Yeah. Okay. So. And there is a Jacobian for the horizontal projection. So just to remind you, I'm lifting this. And so here's the point. Here's where we start. Using this preferred initial point, I will define a static volume form on shape space. Okay. The static volume form that I define in shape space is given by that by just this transition amplitude from this point, from this anchor point that I will talk more about. So in shape space, I'm saying, look, in fact, there's this orbit here that is somehow preferred. It is the most homogeneous orbit, and I'm choosing it as an anchor, and I'm defining the wave function basically doing a path integral from that point to any other point. So that's how I'm defining an amplitude over shape space. Dave.
What determines the point on the initial fiber that you're lifting to?
Right, so that's the question. I mean, it's in fact invariant already. If you write the action that I wrote here was respect to the gauge symmetry. Right, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That's the joy of gauge theory. Right. You can start anywhere on the fiber.
But the fact that you choose, then I guess you choose a stabilizer of the. No, it's not a stabilizer, but it's the most homogeneous shape.
Right.
Nothing to do with requirements.
Right. So it will define. For instance, so let's talk about scale transformation. Right. It will set a reference scale that I'm going to propagate forward. So as we'll see in the example that I give, it will be this unique orbit will be given by the conformal class of round spheres, so everything, well, all round spheres. And you can choose some volume form there. And the horizontal trajectories will keep, they're going to be have traceless velocities. They will keep this volume form fixed throughout.
Sorry.
So it's kind of a choice of this.
I'm kind of worried that maybe that choice of the most isotropic point is actually the worst choice, because there is where the group doesn't touch transitively in your computer.
Oh no, but that's very important for us.
Doesn't it make your connection indefined as exactly that point?
Right. So there are issues, but in fact it's if you go along a conformal killing vector, there you have conformal killing vectors, but you don't go along those. I'll show you. Wait, Vasu. I have not thought about this at all, but it would be nice to.
How do you know that there's a point?
I don't.
At all?
You don't. You don't. This is going to be something that it's kind of selected. You select a theory with this. So yeah, right. So I'm going to talk about this now. I'm going to talk about this. So I'm going to talk about this. This both of these things that you asked about being being unique and it being and this projection actually not forming manifolds. So it is true this metric is unique for if you have the S3 topology and if this is the group and it's the round sphere. And the point that I was saying is that you can see this, well, if you start out from G0 and follow a horizontal curve, so that this is true, the volume form doesn't change, so that G can't go to zero. And the degenerate metrics are not reachable from going from the base space into the bundle through this procedure. So apart from the degenerate metrics, the round spheres have the largest isotropy subgroup of diff. Of the three diffials.
But I mean, this is because you choose this connection, you choose this conformal connection.
Right.
GAB.
Right. That's true. And in fact, so the quotient manifold is a stratified manifold, or it's nested. It's a union of manifolds of increasing dimension. It's like a cube where there's a least dimensional corner. So if I were to draw this, you could draw, you know, a cube if you imagine it as actually being, you glue points to lines, to faces, to the interior. And then there is a point where you stop, which is the point, which is the corner of corners. And the stratified manifold that you form when you take these quotients of superspace, it has the same structure, but in this case, there's a unique point where you stop, which is the round sphere for S3. So it's also a corner of corners, and I think it's very natural to take this as the origin of shape space in that sense that I related to, and that's where I'm going to anchor this wave function amplitude. And as Julian mentioned yesterday, there's some relation to the complexity functional, which they talked about. Because, for instance, if you think about the Amabi invariants, a unique saddle point in this topology is also on the equivalence class of conformal of three spheres. Okay. So the nice thing is that now I've defined this amplitude there. And now I'm just going to start trying to do things that I can, or semi-classical approximations. And for extremum paths, so if I take two points and there is a path that extremizes the action between these points.
The action is the Einstein Hill, but in 3+1 form.
I haven't specified the action. Right. I mean, again, the action, the group of invariances of the action that I'm looking at has to form this vibration. So I don't want refoliations. So if you're talking about that, it should be an action equivalent to shape dynamics, so that it has the symmetries of conformal diffs. And so, well, this is a topic for another day. So here the von Vleck determinant is the second derivative of, so if I write an extreme on action, you find the on shell value for the action between two points, and you find a matrix if you vary here and you vary here, a matrix for the variation of the length of these points. Let's for this talk assume that this action functional is kind of a length functional on shape space. So it's kind of like a Jacobi action, right? I don't know how much you guys are used to this nomenclature, but Jacobi action is basically an action whose extrema are mapped to geodesics of a metric in configuration space. Right. Is there happiness?
Yeah, the only thing that slightly worries me is that
happy with geodesics on configuration space, but I guess when we get down to shape space in the particle model, you don't have a potential which is homogeneous of degree minus two. You can't do it with a new potential. So this does seem to be increasingly a really fundamental issue.
And you can't write a Jacobi metric for that. I mean, this is for now it's very general what I'm saying, but
you can certainly write a Jacobi type metric, but
right.
It requires a potential which is homogeneous of degree minus two.
For n-body.
In the n-body problem,
yeah.
Because it has to match the quadratic Newton kinetic energy. So
for
Jacobi's principle about energy.
For it to be scale invariant.
For it to be scale invariant.
Ah, right.
And so there is an issue there. So
right.
it's only geodesic, it's the potential energy, and the Newtonian terms is degree minus two.
Right.
This is what increasingly Tim and I are coming to see as a really fundamental issue in shape dynamics.
Right.
But how you define the metric. You say it's UV metric.
Right. I don't know. Tim has also been reconsidering that other potential now, right, Tim? Am I wrong?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes, right. Yeah. For but we want to have attractors.
Right.
Of the
yes.
If you have geodesic dynamics on a compact space.
Right. So this, I'm actually not thinking of a compact, I'm thinking of field space, in fact. I'm not thinking of particle systems. But sure, this is a problem for another day. So for now, I think I already have enough on my plate here for this talk.
Restrict your diffeomorphism group to be diffeomorphisms which are the identity of the point and it's
right.
Space. Then,
then it's a fiber bundle. Right, that's true. That's true. That's true, and I don't want that. I do use that to form my connection. By the way, yeah, that's the answer to Flavio's question. I do use, so what Roberto is referring to is that if you fix your diffs to keep not only a point fixed, so you can think of this as kind of like an observer that always stay put, but also a triad fixed, basically something like this. Then there are no more. Then the isotropy subgroups are always are the identity only. You don't have anything else, and then you don't have this stratified structure. Because I didn't explain to you the problem. What creates the stratified structure is that some metrics. Right, you're quotienting by diffeomorphisms, but some metrics have more isometries, have some part of the diffeomorphisms that just leave it fixed. So you're quotienting by different things at different points.
So why is it that you don't want that?
I don't want that because I want that corner of corners. I will use something like that for the observer, which is the definition of how you lift the curve. Because then I don't have the problems that Flavio was describing, which I had forgot, but it's in the paper actually. This, but okay.
The point is that the isometry is a group of the most symmetric ones, the largest ones. So there's no further corner.
Right. There's no further corner. You stop there. The buck stops there. So you can actually, so let me just say a little bit, this is an important structure here that you find, and you find it for oscillatory path integrals, even if you have field theories. This is the definition of the Van Vleck determinant, and it actually has an interpretation, and the interpretation is, if you were to think about geometries, it's basically the integral of the expansion scalar. So it's telling you, if I have a little ball around a configuration point. Sean took this up. So if you have a little ball around a configurations point here, and it has a little volume form, and I have a little ball around a configuration point here, and if I take this, the extremal trajectory is close by, it will tell me how much you expanded or you contracted the volume along these classical paths. This is the interpretation of the Van Vleck determinant. Okay. You can actually think of it as some sort of integral of the expansion scalar along this trajectory. Right. So, yes. So don't think of it as an expansion scalar, as the integral of an expansion scalar. This would be in finite dimensions. But this is. I mean, so this, did I cite him? Yes. So there is a paper by Bravinsky in which he actually defines this. He defines this for functional integrals. How you'd get this. And then you find some semi-classical approximation, and you have this Van Vleck determinant here, and some exponential factor here. This is the on-shell action between two points. Here, kappa is if this is dimensionful, this kappa would define this dimension. You can think of it basically as the number of oscillations per, if this is arc length, if this is a Jacobi action, it have arc length parameterization, this would be the number of oscillations per arc length, or something like that.
It's not like H bar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but if the action is conformally invariant, it's a dimensional.
I don't know how to. Yeah. These are problems that have fried my brain a little. So. And in fact, if you square it, you do find interference effects, and they take into account the differences of the on-shell actions for the two different paths. So you see. Here, Sean, going back to your question. So here, there's a summation over all extremal paths. So these are local. I mean, you could just think of this, if you were to think of this action as being local, it would give you many extremal paths. And each one of these extremal paths is ones that we would find with different initial conditions. Right? So in the sense, they're local. That's what I meant at that point. And then you can find interference patterns between them. So imagine you have more than one extremal path between this point and this point. And you have some interference here, and the semi-classical amplitude reflects this interference, by just calculating how much each of these paths first of all expands this how much they expand and how much they oscillate, and then you take the cosine of the difference. And although, I mean, I haven't really justified taking the modulus squared, right? So for me, if I just told you there is this amplitude and shape space, why is this modulus squared doing here? I have said nothing about the Born rule. I haven't talked about measurements or anything like that. So one of the things is that I promised in the beginning is that I was going to find the form of this function, that I want to create a volume form on shape space, and I have the amplitude. And I told you also that Van Vleck relays the initial infinitesimal volume around QI and a final volume around QF, and is transported by classical paths. And let's just put rho 0 equals 1. And if there's a single classical curve between that, then what you find, well, there's a single Van Vleck. There, it doesn't depend on the path anymore. And then what I find is that if I define the final density as the density of the transported amplitude from Q0 to QF, so F is what gives me the density from the amplitude, and I know that this rho F is equal to the Van Vleck, and I know that the Van Vleck, when there are no interference, is equal to W squared. So you find this chain here. And it establishes that at least if I have this in the semi-classical part, if I have the semi-classical amplitude, then it establishes that fz should be something like z squared. But I also know that fz is positive, so I'm going to assume it has some. There's a more elaborate proof that Wolfgang showed me that it's better than this, but this is more pedestrian. So if you just assume that fz is some polynomial, you here you have coefficients. And here you have just a ZZ bar. And by the decomposition property that I told you, if you actually try if you find any form like this and you match F of Z1, Z2 with F of Z1 times F of Z2, I told one of my properties was that they needed to be the same. You find that you can only have diagonal terms. Match, right? Here, otherwise you'd have cross terms. So to find diagonal terms to match, you need AI equals some A of delta I naught for a single I naught, because if you have more than one, you're going to have cross terms. And you also need A equals one because you're going to have A squared from this one. And then by the semi-classical limit above, you also find that I naught is equal to one. So the only rule to go from an amplitude to a positive function that obeys my criterion, which will be important. That criterion seemed a little bit ad hoc, but it is important. Is the Born rule?
Okay, I might be lost. What's the physical meaning
of all this?
Yeah, the probability of what?
Right, it's not a probability yet. It's a volume form over shape space.
Maybe you can break down the question, why are you interested in the volume form over shape space?
Because I want to count configurations. I want to count shapes and compare number of shapes here with the number of shapes here. Because what I'm saying is that this from this we can find everything we need to know about quantum mechanics and predictions. That's what I mean, that there is no non-unitary measurement, that these things are there and they're just falling from. I mean, this is an idea that Julian really pushed for in the end of time, if I'm not mistaken.
You require a couple other
Right.
Can one summarize this slide by saying, well, classical probability densities and configuration space are propagated by the Van Vleck determinant.
Right.
Now I'm searching a rule to recover this, and the Born rule is the only way to do it.
Okay, yes.
So right. Your criterion, if we're stated in terms of distributions of some kind, then isn't that statistical independence or something?
We'll get to that.
Okay.
It's not gonna be f of I'll show you. Well, I need to go quick, right? Okay, so I'm not going to talk much about this, but there's some notion of coarse grainings of paths around the extremal paths, and basically you need some finite you need to consider some finite number of paths because I can't really explain this now, but the issue is so here's a record, here's what I'm going to define as the pre-record. So this is not the same definition that people give usually, and Julian has more elaborate notions of records as things that are stable and form clocks and systems. Here for me, okay, ignore the tubes for now, they're not really important, but there are precise definitions of what these things mean. But I just say that phi has a record of phi r. It should be q, but in the paper it's phi, and I actually had someone make this for me and I didn't know how to change it. So
it was not Flavio.
For once, it wasn't Flavio. And so I am, if all the extremal paths that go from this origin to this phi pass through this configuration here, I will say that this configuration has a pre-record. I actually usually use record, but I didn't want to mix it up with Julian's nomenclature and other people's. So it has a pre-record of phi r.
All paths or just two?
All the extremal paths.
All the extremal paths.
Right. And you can then show that the semi-classical transition amplitude actually decomposes to something like this. So it decomposes from the transition amplitude to go from here to here, and then from here to here.
That's just unitary.
Well, yeah, but I mean, here you don't have time, so usually you would integrate over all times in an intermediate surface. It's a... And then because of the property of f, which I'm now already calling p of q, it's just f of the amplitude, I find that the probability of q is actually the probability of the record and times the conditional probability from the record to that configuration. So this is what I mean. So in a sense, I am thinking of this as a record, because I'm saying this now is kind of conditional on that happening, on how much that happened.
If there is more than one extreme of path between Q and QR, in getting the W squared, you sum the amplitude and then take the square.
Yes.
And you derive that.
Right.
Right.
Okay. All right, and you can also have multiple records here. I left H bar, but you can have records of records of records. And this would kind of like form this granular history. And you can also find something more pathological for which the records are have different ordering with respect to different extremal paths. And then here you wouldn't have, this would be a record, this would be a record, but neither one would be a record of the other. But okay, let's not get into this. And for the first three cases, so you do have something like this, and this is also what you find in Mott, which I didn't have really time to explain, but it was the same thing. It's basically the in the semi-classical approximation, that's what you would find. And you also note that if you take quotients, you can ignore actually what the probability was to get from the original configuration to the record. You can just think of the records as setting kind of initial conditions. And it's kind of what we would like to have. Okay. How much time do you have? 5 minutes. Okay, sorry. So but I have not put time in, but I still want to define a conservation of probability.
And you put time in, you don't have a set amount of time.
I don't have a time. Okay. All right.
Once you put time in, it's 5 minutes.
All right. And I'll tell you now what I mean by this. Something that I call screen, and you can actually think of this as surfaces of constant, basically of constant distance, arc length distance from this, for paths that have extremal paths that have departed from their origin to here. Here I have exaggerated how much they expand after this, but it's all in field space, so you know. And so by constant action distance, it's arc length for a Jacobi metric. And so here I'm going to have to skip it, but it would be possible to show that for a Jacobi action function of the form, so here I'm actually thinking of these things as having integrated over local x, like in the Witt notation. But in any case, you could actually show that the path integral does satisfy something like this. And it's not exactly really the width because you have integrated over the local dependence here. And then you'd have something for metric. If I put a metric in a source and you do, again, an ansatz in which I have some here, MP would also have some Newton's constant or some relation between the gravitational interactions and the source and gravity interactions. And I decompose this, so I won't really have time to go through this, but what you find is that if you do decompose this, you find that there is some kind of a Schrodinger equation for the matter Hamiltonian defined by the time. So the time is basically arc length time going from a record. Okay. And it's and the infinitesimal flux through these constant surfaces is also given by just the amplitude of the gravitational part. And the important point here is that none of this can be derived if I would have, for example, my wave function as some sum of WKBs. And this is a major criticism of the usual WKB approximation for Willy-DeWitt, because you have no right to justify one Hamilton-Jacobi solution over another.
Superposition of macroscopically different.
Right, you have some superposition, and then you don't have really conservation of probability for either system, and it's a mess. Here, we are kind of safe because we have this anchor point, and we have just this Hamilton-Jacobi functionals. So, quick remark. So, like Hartle-Hawking, I have imposed there are more controversial boundary conditions in superspace. Here's conformal superspace. And there they do derive spacetimes from WKB approximation in mini superspace, apart from the caveats that I have said about superposition of the of this WKB solutions. And unlike Hartle-Hawking, there is a reduced configuration space even outside of mini superspace approximation. In Hartle-Hawking, there isn't, and that's makes some of my constructions impossible, like records. And also, I think of these as more natural boundary conditions in shape space, which naturally correspond to a most homogeneous state, and it's also a corner. Okay, so the geometrical toy model is the free particle in Riemann. So for now, I'm going to ignore, I know it's heresy, but I'm going to ignore a little bit the conformal transformations, the scale. It will, it actually, well, I'll show you. There's, it comes in. So I'll just think of the group of diffeomorphisms, and for no reason, I'll select this. And I have just a very simple geodesic action in Riemann, okay? So G dot is just the derivatives, the time derivatives of the curve. It's reparametrization invariant because I have a square here. I don't feel happiness from.
No.
This is I don't. This is these are particles in superspace.
So it's a gravitational theory of metrics on the free space.
Right.
Okay, so why do you call it a particle model?
Because if you think of it in superspace, these are trajectories in superspace.
What's there?
Yes. Right.
Because it's geodesic in
superspace. Right, it's a geodesic theory in superspace.
Okay, that's better.
What do you call, I mean, you have a geodesic in the n-body problem where you have lots of particles. You seem to be suggesting you just have a single particle.
It's in configuration space. In shape space, you
don't call it the particle model.
I will never call it the particle model again.
Your theory is like a particle in
space.
Right, that's what I meant.
And the metric there is some sort of the metric.
Right. Yeah.
But the square root is outside.
Right.
The square root is
What I missed was your square root in the title.
No, but here you find the same extremal values if you take out the square root.
Yes.
Is the energy functional versus the length functional? So blah, 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 horizontal lift. You can actually find the geodesics explicitly. You can actually find, if you have an initial direction, you find what are the geodesics. And it's quite cute. It's not a very pretty formula, but it's cute. And you actually find a super Riemann curvature. So if you take two vectors in superspace, or two vectors in Riemann, you can actually find what is this super Riemann curvature. And in fact, it is zero if you have any pure trace direction. If you have any pure trace direction of these velocities, the super Riemann curvature is zero. And you also have that geodesics don't reconverge, so there's no interference terms in the semi-classical approximation. They just expand. Well, there are records. There aren't the non-trivial records. There aren't. So there are no real quantum effects in that in the usual sense. There are only these very simple quantum effects of expansions around a single classical trajectory of this von Vleck determinant, but no real effects of.
So there's dispersion, but there's no interference.
Right. Exactly. So here, now I want to calculate the von Vleck determinant of this, and I'll use a trick. For finite dimensions in a geodesic action, I can calculate the geometrical von Vleck, and it's given by this. And this is the distance from x to y. Here is an expansion on the distance. And there's a long story about how to translate this to infinite dimension by Micho and other people. A bunch of papers, and it requires regularization, which is tricky because here my Riemann curvature is actually a tensor, so it's not of trace class, but they define something that they call the pointwise Ricci tensor, and you have some properties that you would like from regularization. Anyways, I have no more time left. So what you find in the end is that for two different initial ranges of initial transverse traceless initial directions, so let's suppose, so I'm now on the three sphere, and I have all this, and let's suppose I parametrize them by by the eigenvalues of the transverse traceless eigenfunctions of the Laplacian on the three sphere. Just if you want some specific parameterization, because these are known for the three sphere. In any case, what you find is that if I have some, let's suppose I have some range of TT tensors and some range here, and I say, oh, their nominal volume is the same. And then I want to see, well, okay, what happens if I just go away from them? And then I look at the screen here, and I want to compare the flux through here with the flux through here. This is what is happening here. Unfortunately, this model is too simple. What you find is that as long as you have the same nominal volume, the relative amplitude, the relative flux is always equal. Because what you find is that because there is no derivative operator acting in between these TT things here, then you don't really select for eigenvalues, for different eigenvalues. It's just too simple. You just actually get them. Right. So my hope, what I've been looking into, and there's some work in this, if you include some Jacobi potential here for the metric, if you don't just have this free particle model, is that you would change the terms in the formula that I have for the Van Vleck determinant. You would find some sort of Laplacian acting between the transverse traceless tensors, and then you could start playing, because then you would have if you have different eigenvalues for the different regions that you select on the transverse traceless space of tangent directions, you would have differences in the fluxes. And so, for instance, if something like this happens, then what you find is that higher eigenvalues of H1 in comparison to H2 mean its relative probability flux is smaller. And so I'm thinking of higher eigenvalues of this. This would be like some conformal Laplacian acting on TT tensors. I'm thinking of higher eigenvalues as encoding more structure, as having more of these irregularities. And then this probability, which I didn't have time to go through, would mean that if something like this comes up, then the higher eigenvalues would mean that the probability flux is smaller if you choose a region with same nominal volume in the tangent space to the three sphere. The probability flux would be smaller. And this would mean that more homogeneous modes would be favored. But of course, the eigenvalues of the TT tensors and S3, they start from this end. Okay, so let me conclude. How did we fare? Am I super late? Okay. So this makes better, I think, now. We have quantum mechanical notions of no collapse of the wave function. You have a static probability density. That's how I interpret it. We can talk about this, as I'm sure we will. I hope so. And you have a true fake evolution in semi-classical approximation. What I mean by that is that it's true in the sense of you actually have it's a true fake, exactly. It's fake.
Alternative fact.
Right, it's an alternative fact. It's true in the sense that there's some ordering that you can find, and you have conservation of probabilities in terms of that ordering, that sort of thing. But it's fake in the sense that it's all static. It's true in the sense that you form, it's all static. The wave function itself, the amplitude is static, but you find something to compare things with, and you define some notion of time along curves in this. There's an ordering. Records give an ordering, which I'm calling here a time in a sense, and you can define what evolution is with respect to this time. And also, I think quantum superposition principle would mix better, because Well, here you have causal structures corresponding to different extremal curves, and they can interfere. So in the picture that I have, you just have, here's, let's say, one spacetime. Here's another spacetime. And they intersect at a given configuration, because here configurations are actually meaningful, or shapes, let's say just shapes. They intersect at a certain shape. And then you can say how they're interfering. So, you know, different causal histories can interfere, but they don't superpose in the usual sense. You just find this interference, and I think that's much better. Right, and the challenge is to recover standard GR, as has been pointed out, or effects that we want, like this dissipation, for example. So yeah, thank you. No, good.
Right away with the discussion session.
Yes, Lee?
So if it's a fake evolution and the whole picture is really static, why do we remember the past and not the future? Why can we change the future?
Well, I don't think we can. In which sense you can change the future? I don't agree with that. I think we're deterministic systems in any case. In this, if you're over a single extremal path, but the point that you can remember the past is that if phi is a record of phi one is a record of phi two is not a record of phi one because there is an origin in terms of the amplitude that I wrote. They can only be records of each other if they coincide.
But you put in the
if they're close.
Right,
yeah.
Well, I put in an initial. I mean, that was part of my principle that I put in the.
So you can only remember more symmetric states. Literally, in his situation, it's more symmetric.
Yeah. But I think it's the question is. Is the experience of the arrow of the direction of time experientially built in, or is it modeled? I assume what you mean by a fake is that it's modeled. It's consistent with what we experience and what we observe, but it's not explanatory.
Right. I agree with that.
It's a past day model.
But isn't the, I mean, one thing I would surely agree with, I didn't quite hear Lee's question properly, but it seems to me that you, like me, in the end of time, say that the very structure of shape space or configuration space, because of its asymmetry, does suggest a possibility that an arrow of time would appear just from that fact.
Right.
And to some extent in our n-body problem, that is also true when we have a potential on it. We have our complexity function and the law. It is very asymmetric when you put the shape potential on it, and the arrows of time are, but it's a symmetric one, I mean, around the Janus point. But I'm certainly very in favor of the idea that the structure of shape space is something to do with the arrow of time, the emergence of the arrow of time, and remembering the past.
Right, an alternative way of doing this would be to actually try to mimic this complexity function by the Yamabe invariant. Right, and actually see if but at least to some extent it should follow what I said, because the unique saddle point of the Yamabe invariant is also the round three sphere.
Sean's question.
Sean or
well? Oh, it was like somewhat related to this question, which I think, I mean, one mysterious thing would be like, why do the records that we have in this instance allow us to have build memories of the past but not be able to make fiction, like equally accurate predictions about the future?
No, but we can make. I mean, look. If you're thinking of you're thinking of a classical system. I have some system there that stores information about the past, and it has another mechanism here that allows it to make models of the universe.
But I'm not saying we can't make predictions. I'm saying that our predictions about the future are not as reliable as our memories of the past.
I'm not totally sure about that actually.
But I don't understand. I mean, anything that you can describe by a curve in shape space, if you can describe you here making models and it has these memories, and it has these memories that these models have been confirmed, this is all also in the record structure. I don't understand.
No, the question is just like, okay, obviously our the memories of our brains, but like, are different. But like, I can tell you what happened yesterday in the news, right? But I can't. I don't have, because I have some record in my brain of that. But I can't use those same records to predict what's going to be on the news tomorrow.
If you're as smart as Enrique, you could.
Maybe.
No, yeah, but maybe the worry is that now is much more complex than 10 billion years ago. But tomorrow is not a lot more complex than yesterday. So if complexity
yeah.
is a measure which some grade runs down to that, tells you you can't make records of your definition to the future. It's not obvious. It's beautiful. It's impressive. It does a lot. But what I'm wondering is, does it do everything that you really want it to?
It might work.
In particular, if you take Lee's point, or I think this is my interpretation, paraphrasing now, is that support comments. Whether the semi-classical past that he used to interpret to invent history, whether that is the history that you find in the actual records, if you identify in your configuration a structure of records and records of records of records, this whole sequence of history books,
mm-hmm.
Whether that coincides with the semi-classical past that you actually used to calculate
So I think, to be honest, you're right. I haven't really made a direct relation between what I have called these prerequisites, which I think are a more encompassing notion. In particular, if you have just one extremal path, you know, and you have points that are all kind of records of this point at the future. But I haven't related them to actual physical structures. I haven't really related them to these models that you guys have with the binary systems and so on.
But that is the binary system where you're observing a classical thing. The thing that for me is still so amazing about the Mott example is that the whole history is encoded in one configuration.
Right.
So, and this is just like, this is why I talk about time capsules and geology. We know that the structure in rocks and fossils are things which led geologists 2 centuries ago to reconstruct, to say there is an immensely long history of the Earth and get a pretty good idea about it. That structure is still essentially unchanged from 200 years ago. So all of history is in one configuration. That's my notion.
Right, and I think that is true because, I mean, if you were to think of something like, so let's suppose this is the Mott explosion, and you have a configuration that has something like this, this would be in the record of something that has more.
Yes, yes.
And that's why these things actually match. You can think of this as having gone through this configuration before.
Because some things locally I understand, but then I can't put it together in a big picture. So can you explain again why you prefer to choose your starting point from the past, from the corner? Because whenever I talk to Julian, he tells me that I want to avoid the special
hang on, you may have got me wrong there.
Certainly I have, so can you explain where I got it wrong? In other words, what would be wrong if you chose a generic point?
Aren't you a bit influenced by me to have a time asymmetric theory as the fundamental theory, Enrique? Isn't this a little bit what's going on?
Sadly, no.
What?
Sadly, no. He's not influenced.
Well, it may be coincidence.
I don't know.
But it seems to me that's, in some sense, is what you're trying to do.
Well,
why don't we answer Rebecca's question first, because I think that's an important point.
Well, all I'm saying, I think possibly Rebecca, is that a completely smooth space, like a round sphere or Euclidean space, has no information at all. And you need to begin to talk about a dynamical law, you need two shape degrees of freedom.
But even then, I mean,
a record of histories, you need many more than two.
You're saying that the history stays there.
Yeah,
I mean,
there's nothing yet. But starting there is
no
problem.
You can move at this point. You just cannot stop at this point.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Then I have the second question. You said that you want to recover standard DR. I suppose you can formulate standard DR in this language that you have.
Well, what I mean by that is recover the observations, or recover it in the sense that shape dynamics would recover it. Recover it in experienced space-time along a solution curve, let's say. If you have solution curves already, if you have a semi-classical approximation, and if you have that there is no interference, for example, and you just have one of these extremal curves. So you have some extremal curve of some action on shape space. But one extreme...
Yeah, could be formulated such that,
The problem is you will never recover GR because you didn't use the actual model.
No, I'm sure that model won't recover GR.
But the
GR.
Question is, can you recover GR? Because if you want a conformal invariant action, let's say, presumably the shape dynamics, classical dynamics is what, so York's idiomatic sense is what you want, but it also has to be preparation transition invariant, which is not good.
This is the difficulty, and this is what Tim and Yuri have been working on is they re-express these extremal paths, not through an action, but they re-express these extremal paths in shape space without reference to external parameters, basically. And that's the difficulty here. If I want to express everything, this action in terms of shape space quantities only, it's I don't know. Do you have anything to say about that? So that's the what.
What would happen if you renounce the conformal invariants and you use the Einstein-Hilbert as your line element? That's representation invariant, but you only have 3D fields.
So you fix a lapse and you,
yeah.
Right? But then you have other problems with number of degrees of freedom, right? Or are you just assuming that I don't know?
Well, it's really the dynamics would be Einstein-Hilbert, but
like with n equals square root g over trace pi.
So it's not clear that you're imposing the Hamiltonian constraint. That's the thing. All the other baggage of your all the other nice features of your
proposals.
How do you interpret Tobin? In a particle model, you can say, I vary a little bit, I allow for a little uncertainty in the position of particles or in the shape of the string that the particle itself. And then I say, that's my measure of typicality, is that volume. I assign a volume to that. But when you do that for field theory, you need to be careful to specify what are the cylindrical sets and what are the measurable sets in field theory. So in the toy model, what do you do there?
So the way that I'm thinking of it, and the way that this... needs to be So you're asking about how will I incorporate more or less degrees of freedom of knowledge about the gravitational field?
How do you define a probability measure?
How do you define in the top model that you actually gave?
Right.
What is the interpretation of?
So the probability in the time model here, for example, I would have a I would use this measure. It's a measure of TT tensors for. It's an integration over TT tensors over the three sphere. For a certain selection of eigenvalues. For these TT tensors, so for a certain range, and if you huh?
Okay, but what variations of TT tensors do you allow? I mean, usually, this is, I don't know about this particular model, but usually the problem is to say which degrees of freedom you constrain,
right,
such that you get a finite volume, because a unit ball in infinite dimensions is non-compact.
Right.
So you can't assign a volume to it. You need to say which degrees of freedom you allow to fluctuate, and all
right.
That is arbitrary. So you have a compact.
Right. So right.
That regularization, basically, you didn't talk about that at all.
I didn't talk about that at all in this case. For the determinant of the Van Vleck. Well,
I mean.
That is something, but I think he's actually asking about something here. What is the range of eigenvalues that I use? And you're right. I am thinking of a finite number of a range of eigenvalues, and there are a bunch of other eigenvalues that you'd have. You're right that they're not. This is not going to constitute a complete screen, because for that I would have to take all the eigenvalues, and these are going to be all.
So it's a cylindrical screen.
Right. I'm just comparing between two different finite ranges, and I'm assuming that. So there's another thing here that I'm assuming is that so this is something that I assume that I talk about in a different paper about the degrees of freedom. That in certain, I don't know if it applies here, but in certain circumstances, you can actually look at the amplitude. It also factorizes between the different. It's basically a cylindrical consistency. It factorizes between the different degrees of freedom of the gravitational field. So I could. What I mean is, if I integrate.
So what do you mean? Which different?
So. I mean basically this. So if I have some basis, let's say I have some basis of.
Okay. So now you're doing.